And we're back to Sundance in the Morning, which also happens to be taking place with Main Street in the Morning. And maybe we can't be on Main Street to see the parade, but we're watching a steady stream of people going up Sweet Alley to join the parade at the brew pub lot. So, Renee Bodley out there in the field, what are you seeing here?
Hey, Rick, can you hear it? I'm going to let you listen for just a second. That is the sound of a march getting started. They're just starting right now to walk down from the brew pub parking lot. I'm standing right outside the Treasure Mountain Inn looking at a sea of pink signs and pink hats. Thousands of people. I can't even give you an estimate on how many are here. And they're from all over. I talked to three generations of the same Park City family earlier. All women. They're very excited to be here. Grandma marched in 1967 for civil rights, and she said she wanted to show her granddaughter how to do it.
Yeah,
there they go. They're heading down.
Renee, it's David Darcy here. Are you seeing any signs that are memorable? Is there a best sign that you've seen so far?
Some I cannot say on air, thanks to the FCC. But there is one that I really like that I thought locals would like that said Trump skis in jeans.
Hey, I've skied in jeans a few times. It's not the worst thing.
And then another one says, something about his comb over. Sorry, it's getting loud here. That they're great signs. We'll post a lot of pictures on our website and we'll be tweeting them out as well. Speaking of Twitter, I just saw online that 40 is bumper to bumper. I heard 80 is busy, 224. The traffic is a mess out there.
Whoa. Take the bus, everybody.
Yeah. And it's a women's march, but this is a varied crowd. Is that right? All ages?
It's very crowd. Yeah. Thank you for that, Rick. There are a lot of guys here, women, older women, younger women, lots of generations. Serena Williams is one celebrity I've seen so far. Honestly, have not seen Chelsea Handler. She's supposed to be starting the march, but everyone has their coats and hats and goggles on or sunglasses on, even though there's no sun out here. But it is Sundance, so you got to wear your sunglasses.
Yeah, so tell me something. Is there a lot of security here? Are the police very visible along the march course?
Yep, good question. There are a lot of police here and people with security jackets on. The mood here just seems to be really energetic. A lot of smiles, a lot of signs, a lot of Planned Parenthood signs. They're holding those up. I did talk to Carrie Galloway, Executive Director of Planned Parenthood Association of Utah. She said it was important that they had a presence here today. It's just a lot of different people out there marching, for sure.
But, Renee, throughout the campaign, there have been protesters and counter-protesters almost everywhere. Is there a counter-parade, counter-protest, any sign of people who disagree with the parade?
No sign of that at all. I did hear from Chief Wade Carpenter that was a possibility, but have not seen any sign of that yet. Now, this march, we're just at the start. And they're going to go all the way down Main Street, take a ride on Hebert, land in the flagpole parking lot at the bottom of Sweet Alley. That's where they're going to have the speeches. So maybe we'll see some counter-protest there. But really, no sign of that. It's overall a very positive, unified crowd here on Main Street.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. If this is, Renee, if this turns out to be a humongous crowd, it'll be interesting to see how it all congeals down at the flagpole lot. And I'm wondering if we're going to be able to get buses and things in and out.
You know, that's a great question. So right now I'm standing on the balcony of this Treasure Mountain, and I've been going in and out of their lobby. It looks like the march is about halfway down Main Street, getting close to the post office right now. We still have a full crowd at the brew pub parking lot, and a bunch of people still marching up Sweet Alley to wind around to the top of Main Street and go down.
Lots of those people are marching. They're coming. I was describing it as a line in a Russian, as a long line of marchers that you might see in a Russian movie in the snow. It's endless right now from where we can.
Do we have to bring up Russia? Really? You had to put Russia.
It's the snow.
If I'd known, I would have put on Laura's theme. But and look, there's a baby carriage out of control rolling down Sweet Alley.
Oh, no. Okay, so. I'm trying to read some of the signs. One says the future is female. The other says thin-skinned dictator with a picture of Trump. Another says I still rise, quoting Maya Angelou. Love Trump's hate. And again, lots of pink hats. Oh, here we go.
All right.
Okay. Well, we're gonna swing from the Renee, thanks a lot. We're going to swing from the drama on Main Street to the drama on Sundance screens. And
thanks, guys. I'll catch you later.
Thanks, Renee. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And we're fortunate to have in the studio filmmaker Brett Haley, who is here with the film The Hero. And so this would be your second film at Sundance?
That's correct. Yeah, I had a film 2 years ago called I'll See You in My Dreams.
And and that was with kind of a golden years love story, is that?
It was, yeah. It was about it was sort of disguised as a golden years love story, and there's a lot of romance in it, but it really was about loss and how to deal with loss and how you can't get through life kind of without experiencing some loss, and that you shouldn't be afraid of it. You shouldn't walk through, you know, life in fear of that. And it's about embracing all the good and bad that comes with this thing we call life.
Mm. Was that the first time you met Sam Elliott or worked with Sam?
It was. Sam was a supporting player in that film. He did a wonderful job playing opposite Blythe Danner. And we got to see sort of his romantic side, which I think a lot of ladies were excited to see that side of him. And they had seen that side of him for a long time, I think. And I became very good friends with Sam, inspired by him. And my co-writer, Mark Bash, and I were inspired to write something just for him. And I sort of jokingly say that The Hero is 90 minutes of Sam Elliott. I wanted to see 90 minutes of Sam Elliott, so I went out and made the film.
Why didn't you do 100 minutes of Sam Elliott?
I like a 90-minute runtime. I think that's a good runtime, an hour and a half.
Do you think the audience for Sam is mostly a female audience?
I don't. I think he's kind of that man that men sort of want to be and women want to be with, for lack of a better term.
Now, that sounds like it came right out of the marketing department.
I think it's really true. When I spent time with Sam on the sort of the circuit, the press circuit, people go nuts for him because he's done some really iconic roles, you know, from The Stranger and The Big Lebowski to Tombstone to Roadhouse. People love him, and he has such a unique singularity about him, his mustache, his voice. You know, he's the voice of Beef, It's What's for Dinner and Ram. He's just such a part of our culture, and yet we haven't really seen him do the level of acting that I think he's capable of. So playing something a little bit closer to himself, something very dramatic, very funny, all sorts of emotions that he gets to show off. Well,
do you think these are roles that a lot of actors his age would like to have?
I think so, because it's personal. It's not necessarily about being of a certain age. I think this character is a flawed person looking back on his life, but I think anybody can do that at any age, and about the decisions and the legacy that you've left behind or the mark that you've left, and trying to kind of come to terms with that, come to peace with that. So I think it could have been anybody. It just happened to be that I wanted to write this specifically for Sam.
Yeah, and you do sort of wonder how autobiographical this is when the program description reads, you know, he hangs out, you know, smoking weed with his,
yeah.
With his former co-star and now dealer.
Yeah, that is all very fictional.
Yeah, I'm
you know,
sure.
There are elements of the character in the film that are kind of close to Sam. The character that he plays, Lee Hayden, does voiceovers for a living. But the character that he was known for a Western, a famous Western called The Hero, and that's what he's known for. But he's way less successful than Sam is in real life. And he's also a lot more miserable than Sam is in real life. And he smokes a lot more pot. Sam is very adamant, and he wants everyone to know he doesn't smoke pot.
This sounds like it's very similar to some Eastwood characters, to some Nicholson characters, men who reach a certain point in their lives who want to, say, amplify or broaden the emotional range of the characters they're playing.
Absolutely. And I think it's really great to see somebody like Sam Elliott, who we equate kind of, for lack of a better term, a man on a horse, be vulnerable, be emotional and sensitive and romantic and funny and insecure and all the things that come along with being a human, instead of just being the sort of, you know, hero, you know, that's why the movie is called that, because right. That's kind of what he's known for. He's known for this great iconic role, but in real life, he's so many more things.
Well,
yeah.
Elliott is, I kind of think of him as the king of the cable TV Western, along with Tom Selleck, but he's also, He's also played a presidential advisor and
he's got range. Yeah,
a wife killer in a TV miniseries.
He was in Ang Lee's Hulk. He's amazing in that film. You mentioned The Contender, which is one of my favorites. And then you look at my film, I'll See You in My Dreams, and you look at the movie he did also called Grandma, and now he's on The Ranch, the Netflix sitcom. He can pretty much do it all, and that was the real reason for me to make this film. I get inspired by great actors, and I want to give them a platform in which they can be great. And that was really the simple and that was the goal here, was just to give Sam that 90 minutes because, frankly, selfishly, I wanted to see it.
Okay, so with an actor like Sam Elliott, do these films finance themselves? When you come to a project, hey, I've got Sam Elliott, here's a script.
It helped a lot, yes. There was, I think, because of what people saw with my last film and what they saw with Grandma and now he's on The Ranch, like I said, it did come together quite quickly, which is always a gift when you're trying to make independent films. And the other thing that happens when you have an actor like Sam, and this happened on my last film with Blythe Danner, is that people want to work with Sam. People want to work with Blythe. So you get these other great people like Nick Offerman and Laura Prepon and Kristen Ritter. And of course, Sam's real life wife, who's an icon in her own right, Catherine Ross. And so it was very easy to surround him with this incredible talent. And it's really great also to have Catherine at the Sundance Film Festival, considering she was in a little movie called Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Right. I think we've heard of that movie.
This little indie called The Graduate.
Yeah, and
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. No, okay, so you've been in independent film for a while. Television is becoming much bigger. What else has changed? When you submitted this pitch to people, did they say, you know, it sounds more, this character could really be better for a series? I mean, they have their own ideas about what might be more easily monetized if you're talking about business people looking at a pitch. What's changed a lot and what stayed the same and independent?
It's interesting that you mentioned a TV series because that's originally how we constructed this idea, was actually as a limited series. And then we switched it over to a film. I'll tell you something that's going on in the TV world right now is that all the big guys are going to do TV right now. Scorsese, the Coen brothers are doing it. Meryl Streep's in a TV show now. That's kind of where the money is and kind of where the esteem is going. It's getting bigger and bigger, and it's not like it used to be sort of an embarrassing thing. Oh, I'm in a TV series, but movies were the big thing. Right. There's a lot more opportunity right now for independent film, and that there's a lot more being made. The Amazons, the Hulus, the Netflixes, they're stirring up a lot of work. Which
Bob Burney's in the next room. He loves the free pitch for Amazon.
Hello, Bob. I hope you liked the movie. Yeah, I think we're in this place of a real burst of independent film. I think TV is also in its golden age, and yeah, we could call it a platinum age now. There's a lot of material, and I think there's a lot of opportunity for storytellers and filmmakers of all. I mean, and let's talk about the Women's March a little bit here because I can't help but notice it and kind of wish I was out there with them. The idea being that the more variety of voices we have in storytelling, the more representation we have, the better. And I think that is all we're getting with all of these avenues of independent film, of television, of streaming services. We're getting more and more voices and more you know, more variety of voices, which I think is really crucial.
The kind of film you're doing here follows in sort of an independent film tradition of allowing us to take a fresh look at a familiar face. I mean, we have Peter Fonda had his Uli's Gold, and Travolta and Quentin Tarantino. Well, that wasn't at Sundance, but
you had About Schmidt, but with Nicholson.
Yeah, and you had I think another two movies that I look at. You look at
Madison County,
Crazy Heart, and The Wrestler. Two good examples of seeing guys in a different light. So, those are definitely the idea here with Sam, and I'm excited for people to see him in the film.
Okay,
and Brett's next film is going to be a martial arts super macho movie.
I'm always trying to surprise something very different next time around, as usual. So
he's going to revive Sonny Chiba's career.
Yeah, that'd be great.
The premiere actually, we were the it doesn't matter if the snows abate, people will come out to see the premiere of The Hero at the Library Center Theater tonight at 9 p.m. and later on your Monday at the Prospector Theater, Thursday at the Eccles Theater in Park City, and your final final showing in Park City is next Saturday at the Redstone. So, Brett Haley, thank you for coming by.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, thank you, guys.
Hi, this is Guy Raz, host of the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Join me for the TED Radio Hour Sunday mornings at 10 right here on KPCW. Each episode takes you on a journey through the world of ideas with riveting speakers from the renowned TED stage. The show is the fastest growing program in public radio history, and it's on Sundays at 10 a.m. on KPCW.
Brought to you by Crandall Capital.
This is Deacon Haymond, head honcho at Haymond Law. In life and in death, we support KPCW. We prepare wills and trusts and provide guidance on income and estate taxes. We can also answer questions about the loss of a loved one or the loss of someone who isn't loved but must be dealt with anyway. Our office is at Kimball Junction, and more information is at deaconhaymond.com.
All right, it's 9:23, and you are listening to Sundance on the Weekend with Rick Bruff and David Darcy. Just a quick look at the traffic out there. It is a madhouse. Everything's backed up. We've got calls saying that 224 is backed up till Cutter Lane. 248 is backed up beyond the US 40 intersection. US 40 is backed up both ways, both coming from the Heber side and the I-80 side, trying to get into town. And then I-80 is a parking lot eastbound heading towards Park City. So if you are going anywhere today, please give yourself tons of extra time. There's snow on the road. There's lots of traffic. The march is going on right now with the rally to follow at the Flagpole parking lot here on Sweet Alley. Sweet Alley and Main Street are both closed at the moment. You can expect them to be reopened around noon. And listen to KPCW all day for updates on traffic and weather.
And we're back with the Sundance Reel on the weekend. And, you know, we can never do a Sundance Reel show with David Darcy without an appearance from the Darcy gang. I'm trying to start a little mythos for you guys here, kind of like the McLaughlin group.
Keep trying, yeah.
Yeah, right. But David, give us the introductions here.
Wow. Well, I have to say something to the credit of these guys. Every filmmaker, or almost all of them, couldn't show up on time or couldn't even show up at all. And we've got these guys who've been making things happen, arriving early, drinking a lot of free coffee and eating lots of free food, which we love to share. But they made it, which shows you, you know, why they've been why they've been so successful. But anyway, John Sloss of Cinetic, how many films are you involved with here?
Oh, my gosh. Through our marketing group and through our sales group and through the films that we've been involved in the financing and legal for, I would say probably around 40.
Right. And we'll get to how big Amazon is in just a second, which I think people might have some sense of. But you seem to have grown in the last 2 years and taken on a lot more things at Cinetic. Talk about that.
Well, you know, it's like a shark. You got to keep moving forward. We did just open a Los Angeles office after 30 years of thinking about it. We hear that's where the industry's going. I think the way this industry is evolving and, you know, the freedom afforded from technology is going to allow people without massive resources to really make an impact. And that's kind of what we stand for.
Mm-hmm. And what's been the most important effect of that evolution that people can see or should be able to see at Sundance this year?
Well, we took on a marketing group a couple years ago headed by Ryan Werner, and he is state of the art, and he's very much in evidence here. I'd say he gets his hands on almost every significant film here. So that's the most visible thing. Other than that, we're sort of going about the business as usual. We focus a lot on selling movies here. You know, this is always the week of the year I work the hardest.
Okay. Now, is the marketplace, if we can call it that, the field of independent film, expanding fast enough to accommodate big players like Amazon and also growing players like Cinetic? Are we talking about a zero-sum game, or are we talking about what appears to be an infinitely expanding universe?
Well, one area I think is, I don't know if it's infinitely, but it's an expanding universe, is documentaries. I think, and to their credit, I think Netflix proved that there is a big demand for watching nonfiction storytelling. You know, there was this sort of renaissance 10, 15 years ago where people started going to the movie theaters, I think spurred by Michael Moore, to watch docs, and that kind of plateaued. But I think what that signified was not a flattening interest in docs, but maybe it's just a harder hurdle to get people to leave the house and go to see them in a movie theater. I think what is being proven now with the streaming services is that people enjoy nonfiction storytelling, especially if it's literary or smart, every bit as much as scripted. And that seems to be expanding.
How do you feel? Bob, first of all, give us your title at Amazon.
Head of Marketing and Distribution, okay. Amazon Studios.
Okay. What do you think of what John just said?
I agree. I think that the doc sort of world has rapidly expanded, and the streaming services, both Netflix, Amazon, other even CNN, have really made a difference. And I think that's been a trend that's been, you know, growing for a while, and it's expanding. I think here you see a lot of that at Sundance, and Tim seems to be thematic this year. There's a lot of whistleblowers and revolutionary docs.
Right. Well, you know, I guess you have something coming from the other side once this man was inaugurated yesterday. Do people want to watch? Now, there's a four-hour Grateful Dead documentary, which I'm very eager to see, by Amir Bar-Lev. Explain Amazon's involvement in that. Do you bring that out as a series, as a film? How does that work?
Yeah, that's Grateful Dead is a series. It's going to be, you know, obviously it premieres here, but it'll be a series in May on Amazon Prime.
And do people, are you confident that people will want to watch 4 hours of The Grateful Dead? Would the median age for that be about 70?
You know, if you look at the running time, it'll be broken up into sections, right? So, but also if you think about their concerts, they at least go 4 or 5 hours. So
right.
I don't think there's any difference. And I think there's a younger, there is an audience, because even the sort of cult of the dead a bit, I think, does expand younger.
Okay, because the joke around here is that the entourage of the dead will be accompanied by more ambulances than Donald Trump's motorcade. But
okay. Yeah, a lot of oxygen. Well, you need that up here anyway, but yes.
Well, yeah, in Park City, yeah. And, I mean, we have a local theater that often books aging rock and rollers, and our joke is, you know, the pitch is, you know, see them now before they go.
And, yeah, but you know what?
The theater did have Leon Russell.
I agree, but I also think if you look at the way that the sort of dead has evolved and everything with John Mayer, like it's got they continue to expand, and so it'll be interesting to see, and it'll be cool to see how the sort of 4.5 hour plus version plays here.
Are you gonna drop them all simultaneously on Amazon Prime?
I don't really know. To tell you the truth. Okay. Sorry about that. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. But you're right, Bob. I mean, long form storytelling, a narrative and documentary, it seems to, you know, be a perfect home on TV or streaming. Or last year, this humongous O.J. Simpson documentary showed at the festival. But to see it all, you had to spend about a day. With occasional bathroom breaks.
Yeah, but, fortunately, Cinetic did something wonderful for the press. We booked it in a theater where you could see it on a big screen for us to see before, and had food at breaks throughout, which was a very nice thing. No wonder you got such good reviews.
I mean, it's interesting, though. I think also if you look at docs, that, you know, there's still the sort of standouts in docs that perform theatrically as well, and then go on. So it's, I think the whole doc universe has been pretty great. If you think about, you know, from last year's Sundance author J.T. Leroy that we did theatrically,
right.
And we did the Jarmusch's Gimme Danger.
Right.
So It's been and one another one that's out now. I'm Not Your Negro. I mean, there's been amazing amount of great filmmaking out
the
there.
And they can be challenging. The one doc that I think will become the favorite of a lot of people here is 7852, about Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, which is the numbers. In case you're not a film nerd, are about the number of camera setups and the number of cuts in the 45-second shower scene in Psycho. It's enormously entertaining. There's an element of this that is the most nerdy kind of film school, and there's an element of this that is a mystery theater. Is it 3,000 or 5,000 or whatever?
I think it's 3,000.
Yeah, but it is one of my favorites so far. So, you must have a very thick skin, because all the people who are not signed up by Amazon are saying that Amazon's way too big and all that kind of thing. How do you react to stuff like that?
I mean, I think that, like everything, I think that Amazon Studios has been an amazing platform for directors. That in our first year, we've had 14 or 15 films that have given not only acquisitions but productions, you know, visionary directors a chance to do pretty amazing films with big support, including last year's Sundance film, Manchester by the Sea, which is going to be probably heading towards one of the biggest theatrical grossing films ever from Sundance.
And last year's Sundance film, Love and Friendship, which did extremely well, the Whit Stillman film. And this may sound like a little log rolling, but I've worked a lot with Amazon in the last year, and the care and feeding they give filmmakers is equivalent or better than just about anybody else.
Okay, let's talk about an article that came out in the New York Times a couple days ago, which announced – I mean, I have to say this. I read the New York Times every day, but often they announce things that we've known about for a very, very long time, as if they're the Museum of Natural History or something like that. They're announcing Big Scoop, A Dog Bites Man – that not all these successful films at Sundance end up making lots of money, which is something that we could have told them 25 years ago. What do you think?
One of my pet peeves.
Were you quoted in that article, by the way?
Are you kidding? One of my pet peeves, it's true. And luckily, I think we've had more than our share of commercial successes from the big sales we had, you know, from Napoleon Dynamite to Little Miss Sunshine to Precious. Every year, also, when we get to Sundance, and I don't think this will ever change, but like IndieWire or someone else prints the performance of the films, the sale films from last Sundance, in the commercial marketplace in the intervening year, and it's invariably depressing. But the interesting thing is that it doesn't seem to stop the buyers. Yeah. So
why is that? Is this like? Are they addicted like gamblers? How do you account for this? Why are the buyers still coming?
Hope springs eternal. I don't know.
Is there too much money out there?
No, there's too much money.
Maybe. I can't hear you. John saying there's too much money.
I was joking.
I think hope, there's more opportunity now than ever for filmmakers, and not every film is going to get sold. Not every film is going to ultimately work, but I think there's so many examples now of films that actually find a distributor and get out and do something one way or the other. Either they perform commercially or they get enough artistic, incredible reviews to fund their next film. So it's hope, but it also is based in a reality of the business is really, really good now.
And if I could add one more thing, that's a little bit of line with statistics, because a lot of those films end up making out in the aftermarket. And
define aftermarket for our listeners, if you could.
Transactional VOD, DVD, streaming services, free TV. You know, films have long lives, and to make those pronouncements based strictly on theatrical, I think is a little sort of old school, naive. Yeah. And the other thing is when you. It's a bigger, you're buying films here completed. You know, the notion of financing a script, which if you probably finance it would cost more than what you're paying for the completed film, is an equally risky proposition.
Well, but you're doing just that. You are doing that.
We're doing both.
Yeah,
we're doing a combination of acquisitions and fully financed productions. And obviously our first year, last year, was weighted towards acquisitions, but we've done – it's really flipped this year to do more productions.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've seen a huge focus on the periphery of the festival on virtual reality, and this has now been going on for several years. Is this a sign of the influence of people who are in that business who can fund things here? Is this a sense that virtual reality is going to be more easily monetized or more widely used? What's happening? Why is VR it's omnipresent, but it's still always at the edge of the of events like Sundance?
Well, I think it's at events like Sundance and everywhere because the technology is, you know, evolving all the time. But I think what's driving it, besides just the money behind the technology, is that they are starting to find, you know, artists and directors that want to find a way to use the format, and it's not the same as film. So I think there's a great hope for that.
What do you think,
and,
John?
You know, it's to Sundance's credit, they've always been on the forefront of innovation. This is the premier film festival of discovery for new voices. They have taken the lead in showing episodics, you know, like the O.J. Simpson. And I think they've been very aggressive about VR. And I don't know that anyone's really cracked it yet. You know, as someone once said to me, get on the ground floor of a $0 billion business. But
there's a Goldman Sachs report that everyone is citing that VR is going to account for X, you know, $1 billion within a certain number of years. But of course, you know, you can call the Trump cabinet to have it affirmed by five different Goldman Sachs people who were there.
I'm pretty confident that eventually a form of VR is going to be very profitable.
Okay. And I think he's right about Sundance, just the their inclusiveness. Yeah. And, like, look what they've done with, you know, the series. You know, they've always included the series in the film festival before anybody, I think. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like I Love Dick and some of the Amazon things are here as part of the festival along with the films.
I think it was my first trip to Sundance. They had the Robert Altman series on the election. What was it called? It wasn't The Candidate. It was something else.
Oh, Tanner?
Tanner. Tanner 88 or something.
Yeah.
Tanner 88.
Yeah, that was that Sundance showed that. Yeah.
There you go.
Is there a Trump effect?
Yes, there's a bunch of people marching in the street.
Yeah.
Well, right outside.
What's interesting is that this Sweet Alley, which was packed with people that looked like something out of Ivan the Terrible half an hour ago, is now completely empty. But is there a Trump? I mean, look, here's the hypothesis. People will be paying less tax. Does this mean that there'll be more money to invest in independent films? Is there any correlation? John. He's laughing, folks. You can't see that.
You know, it's funny.
Radio.
You see these horrifying statistics from year to year about 100 people have the same accumulated wealth as half of the lower half of the world's population. Now it's eight people.
Right. Yeah.
You know,
and half of them are in the cabinet.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So go ahead.
Yeah. If we can pause just for a second and go to we have a reporter in the field who is watching the proletariat. Marching down Main Street.
Actually, I need one. Is this going to come over the speaker? Okay.
Hello, Renee.
You put one more song.
Hello.
Flagpole parking lot. The speeches have started. Terry Orr is addressing the crowd. The march is pretty much done on Main Street, I think. I think it's dwindling to a close. I just walked down from the post office where the tail end of the marchers were coming through. So I think Main Street will probably be opening soon. I'm not sure about that. But we've got a crowd of, I would say, a couple thousand here at the flagpole lot right now.
Do they seem in good spirits, or do they seem any discouraged because of the weather, Renee?
Not at all. In fact, the weather kind of seems to add a whimsical kind of fun atmosphere to it. I think people are enjoying it. Not a lot of people. At one point, I stopped in the post office just so I could send some things out on social media, and only a few people were huddled in there. Everyone just seemed to be really happy to be marching. One of the coffee shops brought out hot chocolate for the marchers, and someone kind of laughed and said, only in Park City do they offer hot chocolate with marshmallows to the marchers and the protesters.
Let me tell you, I don't think they were doing that in Washington yesterday. Okay, in these reports, we have the best signs component. What signs have you seen that show that there's a little humor to this protest as well?
There's a woman who just walked in front of me, and it was a sign I was trying to think of earlier. It has a caricature of Donald Trump and his hair, and it says, "We shall overcomb."
That's not bad. That
not
is
bad.
Not bad.
And, you know, there's serious signs here. There's some climate change signs, people worried about the Trump administration and what they're going to do as far as protecting our environment. There's a sign in front of me that says, "Protect the water. Water is life." Let's see. Another sign, "Are you part of the solution? March with us. I'm in a democracy. Majority vote rules." Lots of signs. Lots of pink signs, for sure, and lots of pink hats.
How's the relationship between the protesters and security?
Very good. Does not seem to be a problem at all. Security, there's some police officers. There was a Provo police officer that I saw who was actually training the dog, I think. And he said that there were no problems that he had seen along the march. I think the biggest security problem maybe is just when it comes to getting the march started and getting everybody going in the right direction. And I suspect it's going to be tricky getting out of here. This is supposed to end at about 11 o'clock, I think. And it's going to be a bit of a traffic jam getting out.
And is the crowd spilling out onto the roads, or do we have transportation can still get around and things?
You know, Main Street was shut down, and Sweet Alley is shut down as well. And so I didn't notice any conflicts between traffic and marchers.
Okay, we've got some heavy-hitting studio executives in the studio right now. Are their limousines going to be able to get them to their next meeting on time?
I guess it depends on how VIP they are. If they're headed down Sweet Alley, maybe not. I think that's still closed. But Main Street, I suspect, will be opening very soon.
Okay, they're VVIP, very, very important people.
Oh, enticing.
Okay.
Well, down here, we still have Terry Orr speaking, and I'm waiting to see if Chelsea Handler is up there.
Besides Terry Orr, who was our local person, you recognize any faces up there on the dais?
You know, they all have hats on. I think I see Chelsea Handler up there now.
All right.
Yeah, I don't see Jackie Biskupski. She was supposed to be speaking, the mayor of Salt Lake. I don't see her yet. There was John Legend. The singer was up here. Saw a picture of him marching a sign. I did not see him in person. I just saw the picture.
So, Renee, what's the breakdown? Is it 10% male, 20% male? What's the male-female breakdown in the marchers?
I would say it's 50-50.
Really?
I talked to a guy who's carrying a sign saying, "I'm a retired firefighter and I'm a feminist." And I went up to him and said, "Why are you marching today?" And he said, "I'm a feminist and my wife made me." And his wife was there with
him. So the new president has brought the people together.
It seems that they... Oh, big tear there. I'm not sure what they just said. Sorry about
that,
guys.
Okay, post Sundance show, I'm sure Renee will be checking in with you. So thanks, and have fun storming the castle.
Okay.
Will
do. Thanks, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I'm sorry to interrupt, John, but you were talking about, you know, maybe 1% or 8 guys have most of the wealth.
Oh, yeah. It seems to me that there's been a polarization in the world of disposable wealth, and the rich are getting richer, and I don't see that changing in the next 4 years, maybe accelerating. And that's where a lot of film finance comes from. And I think as technology expands the ability to deliver content through people like Amazon, not that there's anyone exactly like Amazon, there's going to be more and more opportunity for storytelling. So I think things look
good. I agree. And I think the climate is going to spur, you know, a lot of ideas, you know, films that will come as the Trump administration goes in. I think there's going to be a lot of reaction in terms of films that are being made.
I imagine that you're going to see that effect in the films submitted next year and the year after. I mean, in general, nothing energizes the independent film community like a Republican in the White House.
Well, it's funny that you say that, because the doc Oklahoma City, made by a filmmaker who couldn't get to the studio, I'm told, has some very interesting – oh, and we should mention that Bob Burney is a proud native of Oklahoma City.
Absolutely.
But this film goes through a lot of what you would expect the story of Tim McVeigh and circumstances surrounding Tim McVeigh might be. But it reaches some interesting conclusions for a film that's going to be shown on PBS, and that is he didn't act alone, that the white supremacist movement, also now known as the alt-right or overlapping with it, was very, very responsible for where Tim McVeigh finally got, and that his constant visits to gun shows was also part of that. And it's reiterated in a way that PBS tends to be a little more balanced about, a little more judicious about. But this is really, I found it almost incendiary. And, you know, there are rumors that the National Endowment for the Arts, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and PBS will be privatized. So, you know, maybe that will happen before there's
but
a discussion
they
of this film.
Can they document he was listening to Rush Limbaugh a lot?
He was reading from the Turner Diaries. I mean, any other thoughts about this Trump effect, if there's going to be any? I mean, do you think that that's going to build up capital for films that would be critical of the administration? I mean, it seems to do that at Sundance every year.
Well, I think Bob makes the most important point, is that it's going to galvanize the opposition and the creative community. And I think you're going to see a period, a very fertile period of you know, watching and criticism and awareness.
Yeah, I think it started, you know, in a way this year, if you look at the Sundance, sort of the environmental theme of the festival, it's the start of that. You know, I think it's been anticipated.
Yeah, so, I mean, you guys can remember what the independent film financial world looked like during the Reagan era and the years George W. was in office. Do we see the same thing or on steroids?
Well, I mean, I think the marketplace is different because of companies like Amazon and the streaming service, so there's more opportunities. But, yeah, I think in terms of the artists and the sort of the filmmakers, it's ripe with material now.
Okay, but you have a situation, for example, we bring up Amazon, you hear. During the election, during the campaign, Donald Trump would not allow reporters from the Washington Post into certain campaign events where other press was allowed. Jeff Bezos, head of Amazon, also owns the Washington Post. Any relationship between, and the Washington Post has taken a really pretty adversarial position on its editorial page against Trump. Does that spill over to any position that Amazon Studios would take?
No, no. I don't think so. As a policy thing, it's very separate. They run everything is really run separately. So not by any sort of direction. I think it's more I think we'll look at what filmmakers are doing and what they're presenting to us, and if it's really great and it fits in kind of the artistic and sort of visionary mandate, we would look at it. But I don't think there's no mandate like that.
Yeah. Looking back on 2016, Bob and John, what documentaries were kind of the blockbuster hits, and not just on theaters but across all media? What stands out for you?
That's a good question. I think O.J. Made in America is a hit sort of by any measure. You know, it's complicated because it's on ESPN, but it had a very robust life on iTunes. You know, it didn't have a huge theatrical run, obviously. Let's see, I'm trying to think what else. I do have to put a plug in for Tower, which is a film I'm associated with. It got shortlisted about Charles Whitman animated, and that's also done very well.
And the other one that, it's a plug for kind of everybody here from Sundance last year is Gleason, which, you know, was shortlisted, and we're working with Cinetic team on that a bit too. But I think it resonated in a big way and kind of across the board because of it's crossing into sports, and we had all the competing NFL teams actually come together and in support of Steve Gleason. I was happy to hear that Mike McCarthy, the Packers, you know, had a screening you know, and all the coaches did. But and that's just another plug for tomorrow's game where the Packers are going to win.
Oh, yeah. In fact, Amazon is closing down all operations during the game. Yeah. You can reach them at an answering machine in Green Bay somewhere.
I didn't know the Packers were Oklahoma City's team.
Well, they're not. But
his wife comes from Green Bay.
But Jeannie from Green Bay.
She's from Green Bay.
Yeah. No, she. Yeah, she grew up with Lombardi, was the usher at her church. Yeah.
Seriously. So it's all I'm the from way. Detroit, and we've got a little bit of a grudge. Maybe.
Yeah, we got
a,
yeah.
Unfortunately. Okay, does this mean, when you're talking about documentaries, does this mean we are going to see larger budgets for documentaries because there's a recognition that there's a bigger audience out there? I mean, are we going to see, you know, the $4 or $5 million budget documentary?
I mean, if I could step in here, having been on the ground level for that, the answer is absolutely yes. And, you know, as Amazon is global, as Netflix is global, as all these global alternatives, you know, we sold a film to Nat Geo this year, that the Leo DiCaprio doc Before the Flood.
Oh, which doc is that?
It's called Before the Flood, that Fisher Stevens made it with Leo DiCaprio. And, you know, the chance to get these messages out globally and to get so many eyeballs, and I guess people like me are sort of making sure that filmmakers get fair value for them, I think, you know, resonates up to the budgets, and budgets are going up.
Yeah. Do you want to say something about that?
No, I was saying I think it's true. I think the sort of marketplace, I think, also enables filmmakers to do these long-term documentary projects that spanning years, you know, that are hard to do. And I think John's right. Those budgets are now going to be allowed and flourish.
Yeah. Hey, before our time runs out, I want to go back to the topic of Sundance disappointments, the graveyard of Sundance disappointments, and the remarkable story last year. Give me your take on this. Unless you guys were directly involved in work in Birth of a Nation, but that got standing ovations from audiences, critical acclaim. I think it was purchased for a pretty penny and
$17 million.
Yeah,
17.5.
Yeah,
thanks, John.
Yeah, and people
I'm
were
a student of such things.
And this was the favorite to cure the Oscar so white problem. This was going to be the film that they would shower awards on to prove that Hollywood isn't prejudiced. And then, so what the hell happened?
Yeah, talk about that. Talk about that if you could.
I'm going to defer to Bob on that. He's the marketing.
Well, I mean, obviously the stories that came out, you know, about the history of Nate and everything, it really affected, I think, not only the film's performance, but its you know, and its impressions on the Academy voters and everything. So it was very tough to see that. It really did not, you know, it went from the highest high to like pretty rough opening.
Yeah. Are we going to see Moonlight cure the Oscar color problem?
Certainly with a nomination.
Yeah,
I think, and also just the number of films, Moonlight, also, you know, Hidden Figure. I mean, there's
Fences.
And also just beyond that, the people behind the scenes too. I mean, even last year's hit that we picked up, Manchester, financier. It's an African-American woman who paid for the whole movie.
What kind of budget are we talking about?
I mean, it's in around $8 million plus. I mean, so I think there has to be a not only in front of the camera but behind the camera in both financiers and executive positions. So it's improving.
Okay, we expect you guys to have lots of foresight about what's going to happen, but what surprised you between last year's Sundance and now? What took you by surprise, either in the business side or the creative side, that you hadn't foreseen?
Well, one thing that was interesting in terms of just the theatrical distribution business is in the summer, there was a lot of clearances between where theaters could play certain big movies, right? Not across the street from each other.
Right.
And those have really broken down so that now theaters can play every movie. And that, I think last summer what we saw is like a lot of theaters played multiple screens of the big Marvel movies and the blockbusters, which left fewer screens over the summer for independent films. And I think it was a noticeable, you know, downturn. It was tougher for independent films theatrically to find the room to live. We were very lucky with Love and Friendship, and we also had Woody Allen's movie, but it limited certain. Now, I think it'll kind of even out, but that was an interesting thing in distribution that affected us.
What gets a younger audience into an independent film? Because Love and Friendship and the Woody Allen film, my assumption would be that it would trend a little higher in age. Is that true?
With those two, certainly. But I think it's the subject matter, and it's the ability to reach that audience with social media rather than huge TV buys. So I think that's been a factor. Not only that filmmakers can make films that are targeted to a younger audience, but you can reach them in a way that you couldn't 5 years ago.
Yeah, if you look at what A24 has done, to give them a bit of a plug, they're really dedicated to a younger demographic, and the truism used to be that you couldn't get to that demographic without spending $30 million of traditional media just to sort of carpet bomb their consciousness, and that is really turning. That's turning with dollars migrating out of traditional, more expensive media toward more targeted digital media. And I think that's a great, great, great trend.
Okay, no
I was saying it really is. We have this film coming up called The Wall that Doug Liman, who normally makes these huge blockbuster films, has made an experimental independent film, and it's one that we can use social media on rather than traditional media.
Talk about another thing that surprised me last year. I thought Sausage Party was one of the great films last year. Really unbelievably irreverent, almost nihilistic, and still fun, and this explosion of color and everything. Does that indicate that there's room in doc? And it did okay, I'm told, by Seth Rogen. So what's he going to say? But does this point to anything? Does this point to anything in the future?
And I'm sorry, only a short answer allowed. Sorry.
Well, I mean, I've been involved with a number of adult-oriented animations before, and I hope it does. I hope it's a trend.
Absolutely. No, I think it looks at, the bigger studios looking at reaching the younger audience through different media means and advertising means as well.
Okay. Well, Bob Burney of Amazon and John Sloss of Cinetech are appearing during the festival just around town and probably not in limousines.
No, but I would say one thing, Davidson, both Cinetech and Amazon, at least from the executives, we are super frugal. We walk.
Let me tell you, these guys are not spending all their money on clothes. That I can say.
You got it.
And I will add that Amazon is super frugal by choice. This is KPCW Park City.
Thank you, guys. We'll see you next year. And also David Darcy, the legendary David Darcy of Critic for Scream International. We'll see you next year, hopefully. And thank you all for being here.
Thanks, Rick.
Always a pleasure. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. You're welcome. Fantastic.
You are listening to KPC.